Alex Honnold, and this is my Squarespace.
The U.S. Supreme Court takes up a landmark case on same-sex marriage to decide if gay couples can wed nationwide. Good evening, I'm Judy Woodruff. Also ahead, Europe on high alert. Belgian, German, and French police arrest dozens in anti-terror raids. With threats of attacks on the rise, what's next for the West thwarting extremist plots? As the EPA pushes cleaner energy by moving American electricity away from coal, Wyoming fights back as the hard black rock is that state's lifeblood.
We've been here for generations, and the EPA coming in and telling us what we can and can't do doesn't settle well with a lot of us.
Wyoming can file 100 lawsuits a month if they want, and it's not going to change a thing.
And it's Friday. Mark Shields and David Brooks are here to analyze the week's news. Those are some of the stories we're covering on tonight's PBS NewsHour.
Major funding for the PBS NewsHour has been provided by for 160 years. BNSF, the engine that connects us. From a world of darkness we became a nation of light. A nation powered by electricity. A nation powered by the IBEW. IBEW, powering North America.
Lincoln Financial, committed to helping you take charge of your life and become your own chief life officer.
And by BAE Systems, inspired work.
Supporting social entrepreneurs and their solutions to the world's most pressing problems. SkollFoundation.org.
With the ongoing support of these institutions.
And this program was made possible by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by contributions to your PBS station from viewers like you. Thank you.
We begin with one of the two major stories that dominated this day, Europe on edge. Law enforcement agencies across the continent targeted terror suspects in raids and arrests across at least four countries. The crackdown was spawned in part by the Paris violence of a week ago. From Belgium to Germany, and again in France, heavily armed police were out in force. In Verviers, Belgium, authorities said late-night raids that killed two suspects had disrupted a plot to attack police. They said they found a well-organized, well-equipped cell.
That is the house looking to Verviers.
The house search in Verviers, several weapons were found, including four military weapons of the AK-47 Kalashnikov type, several handguns, ammunition, and explosives. Several police uniforms were also retrieved, and mobile phones, fake documents, and a significant amount of money.
German authorities raided 11 homes in Berlin and netted two Turkish suspects. They are suspected of recruiting fighters for the Islamic State group in Syria. The dragnet also reached to Bulgaria, where a French national appeared in court over alleged ties to one of the gunmen in last week's attacks in Paris. Watching the day's events, the head of the European Police Agency, Europol, warned the continent now has up to 5,000 Muslim radicals.
The scale of the problem, the way the diffuse nature of the network, the scale of the people involved makes this extremely difficult for even very well-functioning counter-terrorist agencies such as we have in France to stop every attack. I think that's really very, very difficult.
The heightened tensions across Europe had Jewish schools in Belgium and the Netherlands closing their doors as a precaution. And back in Paris, more funerals today. Hundreds gathered to say farewell to the editor of Charlie Hebdo, one of 12 people slain in last week's killings. Secretary of State John Kerry paid his own tribute at a makeshift memorial outside the magazine's offices. Meanwhile, French President François Hollande insisted again that his government will not back down in the face of Islamist terror.
We are at war against it. It is not a war against religion, it is a war against hatred. The attacks committed in Paris are an insult to Islam. And in the world, it is the Muslims, I keep repeating this, who are the first victims of terrorism.
Hollande drew support from Washington, where President Obama and British Prime Minister David Cameron formed a united front.
I know David joins me when I say that we will continue to do everything in our power to help France seek the justice that is needed, and that all our countries are working together seamlessly to prevent attacks and to defeat these terrorist networks.
We know what we're up against, and we know how we will win. We face a poisonous and fanatical ideology that wants to pervert one of the world's major religions, Islam, and create conflict, terror, and death. With our allies, we will confront it wherever it appears.
Across the Muslim world, however, there were more marches and angry protests against Charlie Hebdo's decision to print another cartoon of the Prophet Muhammad. In the day's other major story, the United States Supreme Court agreed to decide whether gay and lesbian couples have a constitutional right to marry. It sets the stage for a potentially history-making decision later this year. We'll explore what's at stake after the news summary. President Obama issued a stern new warning to Congress today not to impose new sanctions against Iran over its nuclear program. He said the odds of reaching a deal with Iran to curb the program are already, quote, less than 50-50. And he warned lawmakers that their actions could end all hope.
The likelihood of the entire negotiations collapsing is very high. Congress should be aware that if this diplomatic solution fails, then the risks and likelihood that this ends up being at some point a military confrontation is heightened. And Congress will have to own that as well.
U.S. and five other world powers are trying to get a framework deal with Iran by March. They missed two previous deadlines. In a bid to push the process along, Secretary of State John Kerry met with Iran's foreign minister in Paris today for the third time this week. Britain and the U.S. are beefing up cooperation on preventing cyber attacks. The two nations announced plans today for joint cybersecurity war games. They're also forming a so-called cyber cell to share intelligence on hacking. The U.S. military will deploy more than 400 troops to train Syrian rebels so they can fight Islamic State militants. Hundreds of support personnel will also be sent to locations outside Syria. The Pentagon spokesman, Rear Admiral John Kirby, said today that it will take some time to get the troops battle ready.
If the training is able to start in March, you could be looking at some opposition groups, you know, getting back into Syria and into the fight, you know, before the end of the year. I think that's certainly a possibility, but we've got a lot of work to do before we're there.
The goal is to train 5,400 rebels in the first year. President Obama already authorized more than 3,000 troops to train Iraqi soldiers in the fight against Islamic State forces. The International Criminal Court will make an initial examination of possible war crimes in Palestinian territories. That could include actions by Israel and the militant group Hamas during last summer's war in Gaza. The Palestinian Authority accepted the court's jurisdiction last month. Israel condemned that move and today's announcement. Fighting escalated in eastern Ukraine today, dimming any prospects for new peace talks. Government forces and Russian-backed rebels stepped up their battle for the airport at Donetsk, a city held by the rebels. So far, two ceasefires have failed to stop the violence. European space scientists had some good news today. An unmanned British spacecraft that disappeared over Mars long ago has been found. Beagle 2 was spotted on the Martian surface by a NASA craft orbiting high overhead. We have a report from Alok Jha of Independent Television News.
Lost on another planet for 11 years. This audacious piece of British engineering has now been found in the barren wilderness of Mars.
Beagle 2 is no longer lost. And further, it seems we are not looking at a crash site.
Beagle 2's mission was to look for signs of life on Mars. It separated from the European Space Agency's Mars Express mission on Christmas Day 2003. But then it disappeared. What we know now is that Beagle 2 seems to have reached the surface of Mars in one piece, and two of its solar panels even deployed when it got there. But then it never got back in touch with home. Frustratingly, it seems to have been recording scientific data on its descent, and even recorded something on the surface of Mars too. But we'll probably never know what it found out. Christmas Day in 2003 was devastating, not least for Beagle 2 project leader Colin Pillinger.
Unfortunately, we don't have any Beagle data in the telemetry for this part.
He died last year without knowing what had happened to his lander.
Beagle 2 was named for the ship that carried Charles Darwin on his voyage of discovery in the 1830s. Back in this country, Medicare and Medicaid Chief Marilyn Tavener unexpectedly stepped down today. She presided over the troubled rollout of healthcare.gov under the president's health care law. And later, she overstated the number of people enrolled for coverage by 400,000. Tavener told staffers today she's leaving with sadness and mixed emotions. Penn State University and the NCAA have reached an agreement that restores more than 100 football wins to the school. They had been officially erased by a 2012 consent decree in the child molesting scandal involving a former coach. Alumni and fans challenged that decree in court, and news of a settlement came today. It means the late Joe Paterno will regain his status as the winningest coach in major college football history. And Wall Street went into the weekend on a high note. Stocks rallied after oil prices surged back above $48 a barrel. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained nearly 191 points to close at 17,511. The Nasdaq rose 63 points to 4634. And the S&P 500 added 26 to finish at 2019. But for the week, all three indexes lost between 1% and 1.5%. Still to come on the NewsHour, same-sex marriage at the Supreme Court. Why 2014 was the warmest year ever recorded on Earth. How Wyoming is at loggerheads with the EPA over energy production in the state. The Justice Department makes a major shift on assets seized by local police. Plus, Mark Shields and David Brooks analyze the week's news. While aspects of same-sex marriage have been debated at the U.S. Supreme Court, today the nine justices agreed to hear arguments at the heart of the debate. Should gay couples be allowed to marry nationwide? They will consider cases stemming from four states. The arguments will be heard in April and a decision announced in June. For more on the court's move, NewsHour contributor Marcia Coyle of the National Law Journal joins us. Marcia,
hi, Judy.
A big day.
Absolutely.
So we know gay marriage is now legal in 36 states. What's the significance of court taking up these cases from Michigan, Ohio, Kentucky, Tennessee?
Well, as you probably remember, last October, the court had seven cases and it declined to review those cases. The big difference between October and today is the fact that in November, a lower federal appellate court broke with the trend across the lower federal appellate courts and upheld state bans on marriage by gay and lesbian couples, as well as bans on the recognition of legal out-of-state same-sex marriages. So that created a circuit split, which is one of the key criteria for granting review by the Supreme Court.
So that was a couple of months ago. Any sense of what, I mean, other than the fact that there's a split, any sense of why the court would jump on this and say, all right, we're now ready to look at this?
Well, I think they were waiting for the right cases to get to them. But I really do think the circuit split was something very important for them, because the Supreme Court wants to ensure uniformity of federal law, uniform application of the federal constitution. And here you had the Sixth Circuit saying in four states these bans were okay, but you had all these other circuits saying they're not okay.
So what is the main question they're going to be wrestling
with?
The
justices actually fashioned two questions. Even though they took four cases, they're not going to hear four separate arguments. They consolidated those cases, and there will be a decision on two questions that they told the lawyers in the cases to brief and be prepared to argue. First, does the 14th Amendment require states to license marriages by same-sex couples? And second, does the 14th Amendment require states to recognize same-sex couples who are legally married out of state?
So do previous rulings by this court tell us very much about how they're likely to go on this next question?
Well, it's hard to say, Judy. We know that in 2013, the court took up the definition of marriage in the Federal Defense of Marriage Act. And that definition said marriage was between one man and one woman. And the courts, in a 5-4 decision, struck the definition as it applied to legally married same-sex couples. So the court was divided there. But the majority opinion had two very important strands: equal protection and federalism, that marriage had always been the province of the states to regulate. So it's going to be very interesting what the court's dealing with today. Are state laws, not the federal law. And we'll just have to wait to see how they view the role of the states here today in this type of issue.
So I know it's always dangerous to speculate, but I was reading today, the sense is that it's clear how some of the justices are going to go one way or another, but it's not at all clear how some in the middle will go. Who are you watching more than anyone else?
I think I'm going to be watching Justice Kennedy, as always, although he wrote the 2013 majority opinion in the Federal Defense of Marriage Act. And he's been very strong in prior cases involving gay rights under the Constitution. But I'm also going to watch, I think, the Chief Justice to see what he does. His dissent in that 2013 case focused on the federalism aspects, but I'm not sure, you know, where he really stands here and what's going to go through his mind in terms of the fact that this is one of the most important social civil rights issues of our time. And I think he's going to be very conscious of that, conscious of the fact that 36 states now allow same-sex marriages, and conscious of the court and its standing as an institution in society, as well as he has a lot of integrity, I believe, in terms of how he views the Constitution. So I think he's going to be a very interesting figure to watch in this. I think Justices Scalia, Thomas and Alito are leaning against same-sex marriages based on what they wrote in that 2013 case.
Well, this one is one we are all going to be looking. I know you're going to be at the court and watching.
It raises the stakes, and they already had a potentially major case on the docket, the challenge to the Affordable Care Act.
So this is the second really big one,
yes.
This year. Marcia Coyle, we thank you. We'll see you in April, but certainly before that.
You will. My pleasure, Judy.
Thanks. Scientists report that 2014 was the hottest year in recorded history for the planet, and that dates back to 1880. This was announced today by both NASA and NOAA, the Oceanic and Atmospheric Agency. 5 months last year set temperature records. The ocean surface was unusually warm around the world, except for Antarctica. In the U.S., the western part of the country baked under extreme heat, shown here in yellow, although the eastern half of the country saw below-average temperatures, as you see here in blue. And there were temperature records set in several European countries. Well, we get further insight and information on all of this from one of the lead scientists involved with the report. Gavin Schmidt studies climate change at NASA's Goddard Institute for Space Studies. And Gavin Schmidt, we welcome you to the program.
Thank you very much for having me.
So fill this out a little bit more for us. How did 2014 differ from other years?
Well, 2014 was only a little bit different from previous years, but what we're seeing is a long-term trend that is producing record warm year after record warm year. The previous record was in 2010, before that 2005, before that 1998. So this year is part of a long-term trend that is just going to continue.
But when you say it's only a little different, I mean by a fraction of a fraction, is that right?
Right. I mean, so there is each year that makes a record, it's like people running a marathon. You know, they only beat the record by a few seconds each time. But times are getting faster. The globe is warming up.
And am I right? I believe I read today that the 10 hottest years on record have all occurred since 1997.
Yep, that's right. Nine of those have occurred in the last 10 years. 1998 was a real standout year, and so that's still in the top five. But we've warmed about 1.5 degrees Fahrenheit since the beginning of the 20th century, and we can attribute those changes mainly to the increase in greenhouse gases, particularly carbon dioxide, that we've been putting into the atmosphere.
And just to be clear, we showed a map of the United States, the western part of the country very hot, but the eastern part cooler, but you still had overall this record.
That's right. I mean, in any one year, there is a lot of variability. You know, sometimes you have an El Nino event in the tropical Pacific that can make a difference. You always have weather and various natural variability that's going on. And so you never see a uniform pattern. You're always going to see some places that were warmer, some places that were cooler. But in our analysis, we're trying to average over all of those things to get a sense of what the whole globe is seeing on a long time scale.
So what do you and other scientists believe is going on here?
Well, so year to year, there's a lot of noise, there's a lot of chaos and dynamism in the climate system. But the underlying trend, the trends that we've seen since the 1970s particularly, that's being driven, that's being pushed. And it's being pushed mainly by carbon dioxide increases in the atmosphere, which are adding to the greenhouse effect, which is making the planet warmer.
Carbon dioxide, meaning man-made emissions.
Carbon dioxide mainly comes from the burning of fossil fuels, coal, oil, natural gas, and from deforestation, mainly in the tropics.
So to the skeptics who are out there vocally when a report like this comes out saying, wait a minute, there's no proof that there's connection to what humans do, you say what?
So, you know, science works by putting all the bits of evidence together. We've looked for all sorts of different fingerprints of change. We've looked to see whether the warming is caused by oscillations in the ocean, or whether it's caused by changes in the sun or volcanoes or all sorts of different things. But what we find is that the picture that you get when you think about what's happening with greenhouse gases fits the data not just at the surface, but in the but higher up in the atmosphere, in the ocean, in the Arctic, all around. And so we have a fingerprint of change that's associated with human activities, and that fingerprint fits the evidence that we're seeing in the data.
Separately, Gavin Schmidt, we saw yesterday in the journal Science this report that humans, it basically concludes, are causing unprecedented damage to the oceans and to life, to animals' life in the oceans. When you put that together with the temperature findings, what does that tell you?
Well, human impact on the planet, with the population that we have and the huge exponential growth in population, we're having exponentially growing effects on the planet across a whole suite of different metrics, whether it's ocean acidification, whether it's overfishing, whether it's habitat loss, whether it's deforestation. All of the graphs look very similar. It's flat for a long time and then it shoots up. We're in that exponential growth phase, and we have to be very, very careful that we don't exceed our reach and damage systems that can't be recovered.
Any glimmer of hopefulness in all this?
Well, I think the glimmer of hopefulness is that we're having a conversation about that. We're discussing these things, hopefully in a sustainable manner. We're talking about ways to mitigate and to adapt to the changes that we're coming about. And these kind of conversations that we're having now help raise awareness and help us make sure that the people who are making decisions are making decisions in the full light of the scientific evidence that we have found.
Gavin Schmidt, who is the director of the Goddard Institute for Space Studies at NASA. We thank you.
Thank you.
The rise in greenhouse gases and temperatures are the reasons why the president has issued new restrictions on coal-fired power plants in this country. But now that Republicans hold control of Congress, one issue high on their agenda, blocking or delaying the EPA's plans. We get a report on how that is viewed in a key energy-producing state, Wyoming. It comes from Lee Patterson of Inside Energy. That's a public media collaboration on energy issues, working with the NewsHour.
Caring for a few hundred cows during a Wyoming winter is hard work. Sub-zero temperatures and hurricane-force winds are normal. Rancher Dave Hamilton says it's part of the disconnect between people who live off the land and those who regulate the environment.
We seem to have people that have never ever even set foot in the state of Wyoming, that don't understand farming, don't understand ranching, pass rules that affect us all, when in fact we all want to keep our land together. I mean, I can't make a living if I destroy my land.
In 2010, the EPA sued Hamilton for building an irrigation ditch that it claimed violated the Clean Water Act. His lawyer says the agency was seeking hundreds of thousands of dollars in penalties. But when the case went to court, the jury ruled in Hamilton's favor because farming and ranching are generally exempt from the Clean Water Act.
We don't want to have air like China, and we don't want to have water that has so much benzene in it that all the fish are dead. But I think the problem is that if we would have interaction that creates solutions, where what we're having is, you can't do this, we don't know what you're going to do about it, but you can't do this because we're going to fine you.
This is about protecting our health, and it is about protecting our homes.
In June, EPA Administrator Gina McCarthy announced the Clean Power Plan. It's the agency's newest proposal to cut carbon emissions.
All told, in 2030, when the states meet their final goals, our proposal will result in 30% less carbon pollution from the power sector across the United States in comparison to 2005 levels.
People here in Wyoming care deeply about issues that affect their land and energy resources. And this plan is threatening because it aims to slash carbon emissions by 30%, in part by moving American electricity generation away from coal. And this hard black rock is Wyoming's lifeblood. Mineral extraction accounts for nearly 75% of the state's revenue, about a third coming from coal. Funds things like schools and road construction and a huge state savings account.
Wyoming has a long history of coal mining, and these days, the state provides nearly 40% of the nation's supply. But the top executive at this mine does acknowledge concerns about emissions from burning coal.
Colin Marshall is the CEO of Cloud Peak Energy, one of the largest coal companies in the country.
I believe the science is clearly not settled. But there's some theories out there, and if they're right that CO2 emissions are significant, then they could, you know, potentially could be very a big impact on the world and its climate. And I always think, well, what happens if the impact of climate change are twice as bad as people are thinking?
Marshall believes the answer is the technology shown here at the Boundary Dam Power Station, the world's first and only carbon capture power plant. Components like this absorber tower are bolted on and then remove the harmful CO2 right out of emissions.
Let's develop the technology so if it's appropriate to play that card, we've actually got the technology we need.
Boundary Dam opened in Canada last year. But installing this technology on a wide commercial scale is almost prohibitively expensive. And so coal country is fighting back against the Clean Power Plan. In August, Wyoming, along with 11 other states, sued the EPA, hoping to derail the proposal. But this is just the latest chapter in a long history of conflict. Since the year 2000, the state has sued the EPA 12 times over issues like regional haze and mercury emissions. And that doesn't even include the lawsuits it's joined on behalf of other states. Professor Harold Bergman specializes in environmental toxicology.
Wyoming can file 100 lawsuits a month if they want, and it's not going to change a thing. This is going to get fixed. It absolutely must.
He says Wyoming lawmakers need to recognize the realities of a changing climate.
The consequences for the coal industry, for instance, are going to be severe, and they have to begin adjusting for it now. If they don't, we're going to be blindsided.
The sole U.S. House representative for the state of Wyoming does not share this sense of certainty.
The climate is changing. The climate is always changing. And the science on mankind's role in the change of climate is simply not as well established as one would have us think.
As the chair of a brand new subcommittee focused on energy and environmental policy, Lummis says she will work to gather information on how the EPA's policies affect people. She and her fellow legislator, Wyoming Senator John Barrasso, who chairs the Republican Policy Committee, believe the Clean Power Plan would result in job loss and higher utility bills. And so blocking it is a priority among Republicans in leadership positions. Lummis hints at their strategy here.
We will have the power of the purse and can use it in a way that will allow us to send messages to the president that certain policies and rulemaking is having a negative impact on jobs and the economy, mostly in rural America and in energy-producing areas of our country.
At Jake's Tavern, a popular hangout in coal country, energy worker Brandon Alley says the issue is not so much about politics, but more about Wyoming's rugged, independent mentality.
There's a lot of us around here that we've been here for generations, and the EPA coming in and telling us what we can and can't do, or making it really hard for us to do what needs to be done, just doesn't settle well with a lot of us.
Wyoming exports more energy than any other state, so there's a lot on the line in the debate over the Clean Power Plan. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Lee Patterson in Wyoming.
U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder today announced a major shift in how state and local police departments are permitted to seize and auction off property from those who are not convicted of a crime. Hari Srinivasan has more.
The practice by police departments is known as civil forfeiture, and it's raised nearly $3 billion for local departments around the country. But the practice has been controversial because property has been seized from people who are only suspected of a crime but not convicted. To talk more about this is Sarah Stillman, a staff writer for The New Yorker magazine. Her reporting nearly 2 years ago brought to light some of the abuses of the policy. So, Sarah, I tried to do it justice with a really tiny description, but explain civil forfeiture and what's gone wrong with it just so we have an idea of why this is so significant today.
Well, civil forfeiture is basically a tool for law enforcement to seize people's property, their cash, their cars, other goods, and basically appropriate it if they believe that it has been used in the course of a crime. Now, the problem with it is that often that's been based on suspicion alone, so people don't actually have to be proven guilty of a crime before their property is taken. So the big news today is that Eric Holder basically announced that they were more or less ending a federal policy that had allowed local and state law enforcement agencies to take people's goods, turn them over to the federal government for forfeiture, and then they would get to take a lot of that money back and keep it for themselves.
So what kind of an impact will that have in all of these different thousands of police departments that use the federal law as part of the reason why they should be able to seize some of the property from someone that they pull over or involved in a crime?
Well, it's really a starting point. So it means that, you know, there will be more accountability at the local level. But a lot of this takes place at the state level when you're seeing abuses. And sometimes, you know, some of the cases I wrote about in a piece for The New Yorker some time ago involved people who, you know, an elderly couple in Philadelphia, for instance, whose son had sold about $20 worth of pot on the porch, and or at least he was alleged to. He hadn't been proven guilty of the crime. And the family learned that after their home was raided by a SWAT team, the home was actually going to be seized and sold at an auction to benefit the city with those funds. So you're still seeing abuses like that at the local level that won't be stopped by this, because this is essentially ending a federal program of cooperation.
Okay, so when we're talking about $2.5 or $3 billion in seizures, even any significant dent is that like that is going to have resistance from law enforcement agencies, right?
Absolutely, because one of the issues with the perverse incentives is that law enforcement has become very, very dependent on these funds. And we've seen in many cases local police departments really don't have a lot of resources beyond the pool of money that they get from forfeiture, which can really be quite sizable. I mean, I looked at some small towns in Texas where almost the entirety of police operations, everything from money they were using to buy guns, to buy a lot of the things that you're seeing in these massive SWAT raids, all of that was coming from forfeiture funds.
And are we seeing a slight shift in the political climate? Because there was a little bit of bipartisan support today for trying to rethink these laws.
I think it's tremendously exciting. I think it's one of the areas, there's so many criminal justice reforms going on right now that are bipartisan. You see a lot of support on the left and right, and across the political spectrum, people have been calling for more comprehensive reforms. Both there's been conversation about federal there's been legislation proposed, and there's also many people looking at this at the state and local level to push reforms.
So what's motivating that? Is the shift that we were more concerned 20, 30 years ago when these laws went on the books to say, let's get the criminals off the streets, let's take away the cash and the cars and maybe make some money off of it, now and it's more of an encroachment on our personal freedoms?
I think we're at a moment when we're really reassessing a lot of what came out of the war on drugs. So these laws emerged from the 1980s, and they came out of, in many respects, a very good place, which is that people should not be able to profit from their crimes. But as they became this means of funding law enforcement, a lot of that spun out of control. And I looked at a lot of places where, for instance, in Detroit, a bunch of kids were at a party at an art museum. A huge SWAT team raids the place, and they seized all of the young people's cars without ever actually going through real procedures in court to prove them guilty of anything. So I think we're at a moment when we're really rethinking police militarization, and these issues are really intertwined.
So while those particular anecdotes sound heinous, I mean, I would imagine a law enforcement official will come back and say, you know what, some of this does help us to make sure that they don't have access to the resources to keep committing these crimes. So how do you figure out what is appropriate civil forfeiture or seizure and what's abusive power?
Well, there's two things about that. So one important aspect of the reforms that were just announced is that there are exceptions for issues of public safety where there are firearms involved or other things of that nature. And so I think that's important to understand. I think there's a lot of ways in which the reforms that are being called for are still sort of part of a larger conversation that needs to be vetted in the public sphere.
All right, Sarah Stillman of The New Yorker magazine. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
This week, congressional Republicans met to plot next steps with their newfound power in Washington. And there were more steps taken by potential 2016 presidential candidates as they gear up to run for the White House. For all that and more, we turn to the analysis of Shields and Brooks, syndicated columnist Mark Shields and New York Times columnist David Brooks. It's so good to see both of you.
Thank you, Judy.
So before we talk about politics, I want to ask you about what I discussed with Marcia Coyle earlier, Mark, and that is the Supreme Court announcing it is going to take up the same-sex marriage question. Thoughts?
Well, as Marcia pointed out, along with the Affordable Care Act, which the court is also considering, these are two big ones. But Judy, David's made the point here before about the velocity with which this issue has moved. On May 6, 2012, Joe Biden, the Vice President of the United States, said he was comfortable with with same-sex marriage on Meet the Press, and it absolutely exploded. I mean, how could he do this? He put the president in a terrible position. Now, that's 3 years ago. We just missed Rob Portman, Republican senator from Ohio, announced that he was not going to run for president, going to run for re-election. He would have been the first Republican candidate for president to endorse same-sex marriage. This issue has moved so far, so fast, 36 states, as Marcia pointed out. So, you know, there's a little bit of an anticlimactic feel to it, even though it's great importance constitutionally.
David?
Yeah, you have to think about it. Go back 2,000-3,000 years of prejudice against gays and lesbians, and it's sort of washing away. And so you ask, how did it happen? I think partly it was activism. Partly it was people getting to know each other, partly effective media. Media rarely changes culture rapidly, but a lot of the shows that had gay and lesbian couples changed rapidly. And then there was the selection of the issues. The two big issues that really have been at the central of this for the last 10 years have been gays in the military and marriage. So it was two institutions at the core, and I would say the conservative core of American culture. And by saying, we just want to be married, we just want to serve in the military, people were coming out, and they were coming out in full human dignity in a way that showed respect for the institutions of our country. And once that embraced, then the country has begun to embrace them as individuals, and then the institution of gay marriage.
We heard Marcia say it's going to be huge. It's going to be historic when it comes out. Okay, politics. This is the week, as we said, the congressional Republicans met in their retreat. Mark, this is a time when you've got not just Speaker Boehner, but now the brand new Republican majority leader in the Senate, Mitch McConnell, trying to corral these big numbers in both bodies. What do you see? Do you see the Republicans coming together, or do you see them still having to deal with some rump right wing conservative critics who are just going to continue to give them a hard time?
Well, Speaker Boehner had 25 members of his own caucus not support him for Speaker. That's more than 1 out of 10, more than in recent American history. I mean, that's happened where a Speaker has failed. So he, even though his numbers were enlarged of Republicans in the House, his own position was somewhat shaky at the outset of this Congress. And you have the tensions within the party. After the 2012 election, the Republican Party went through a soul searching in which they came out with a rather serious document saying the party is seen as too narrow-minded, out of touch, not mainstream, mean-spirited, unappealing to non-whites and to women and to younger voters, and we have to do it. We have to endorse immediately comprehensive immigration reform. And you've got a party that was just won a big election, totally on the opposite. So now the first action they take is the House passes a bill that is, quite frankly, restrictive and punitive, even to as far as DREAM Act members are concerned. Those are those who were brought here as children and have grown up and gone to school and so forth.
The president's executive action.
And the president's executive action. And it can't pass the Senate. Mitch McConnell knows he hasn't got the votes. And I just think it's not the issue Republicans wanted right at the outset to deal with. I think Boehner felt he had to deal with it because Republicans had made it such a centerpiece of their campaign. But I don't see it. They're working out the difficulties and the wrinkles very much in public, and I think rather awkwardly.
You see they're united, or how do you see it?
Well, it's a governing party, it's a majority party, so there are bound to be fringes, and we saw both the left and right fringe of the party protesting what was going on. I actually agree with Mark completely. You know, they win this big victory, and what do they decide to do? Well, they decide to pick its charge. They decide to pick a campaign they cannot possibly win. So the House passes a bill that cannot possibly pass. So what's going to happen? They're going to have to walk embarrassedly down the hill in defeat. That's just going to happen. And so why do you do that? I think the reason you do it is because you've got an opposition mentality that says, let's make a statement. We want to show the president we're standing up to him. And so they make a statement instead of passing a law. But if you're in the majority, you're in the majority. And you got to start thinking that way. And I think the part, I don't blame McConnell and Boehner. I blame the rank and file. You got to start thinking like a majority. Are you here to make statements? Well, go to Fox or, you know, do what we do. But if you're going to pass laws, you actually have some ability to influence that.
And Judy, we've seen this movie before. In other words, pick it up on David's point. That is that they have to come to reality. They have to fund Homeland Security by the 27th of February. Right. And there's not going to be a government shutdown. And every story we read, whether it's out of Belgium, whether it's out of Northern Europe, whether it's across the globe, is about terrorist threats or plots or actual events. And the idea that Homeland Security would be put on hold and not fully funded or more funded is absolutely incredible. So they have no bargaining chip and no bargaining power, and it's just to suffer this sort of symbolic defeat.
Well, let's talk about another part of the Republican story, and that is the race for president. We've seen so many names out there, David, but I think one of the remarkable things this week was Mitt Romney. A lot of pushback from other Republicans, including, I think, one of his campaign co-chairs, about his looking seriously at running again.
Yeah, well, the donors don't seem to like him. The Republican committee people don't want him to run again. And the field is just a lot stronger this time. I mean, he ran against people who couldn't possibly win, so he won more or less by default. So there are people who lose and get renominated, but there are people who have passionate, intense followers who believe in them. And so Adlai Stevenson, William Jennings Bryan,
Reagan.
And so there's just an intensity. These people will walk through hell for a certain guy or a man or a woman. And if those people exist for Mitt Romney, they're like in a phone booth in Massachusetts somewhere. He never generated that sort of intensity. People liked him. He's a decent guy. But he never generated that intense followers. So when he announced he's running again, people look at it very coolly, very practically, and said, you had your shot, buddy.
I wouldn't be so quick to write him off. I would say that the other example of somebody who was renominated was Richard Nixon, and didn't have great passionate, intense followers, but Mitt Romney sort of followed the Nixon formula. Was after he lost in 60, Nixon campaigned across the country in 64 and 66. Romney, after 2012, became the national Republican surrogate in 2014. He went everywhere, and he was welcome everywhere. And I think that was as long as he was being contrasted to Barack Obama. Mm. And Barack Obama was at the lowest point of his presidency, and maybe in some buyer's remorse on the part of some voters. I think that David's right. That there's more options now. We're not talking about Herman Cain and Donald Trump, but we've also got a field that doesn't have dominant figures in it. And you're in a competition. Jeb Bush has accelerated this system.
Right.
You've got your competition for fundraisers, for talent who work in the campaign, and to inspire and engage voters. I mean, whoever can do that, that's the competition.
But also the mood is, first of all, people are really sick of this, the status close, so they want change, they want freshness. But then the mood toward all these other candidates who are floating out there is kind of intrigued. So some people are sort of intrigued by Marco Rubio, or intrigued by Ted Cruz, or intrigued by Chris Christie. They're sort of like interesting figures, and you sort of want to see how it'll play out. And I think Mark and I agree, the John Kasich juggernaut is unstoppable. The Ohio governor.
Ohio, the mother of presidents.
We've heard you mention him before.
I think John Kasich is undervalued as a candidate. Mark disagrees slightly, maximally. But they're interesting figures out there, and so you don't need to go back to somebody you've already known too well.
So it's not that you're saying it's not that there's a front runner out there, but there are several folks who could develop into something.
This is a party that has always had a front runner. Since in the last 60 years, Judy, with one exception, the Republican candidate who led in the Gallup poll 1 year before the convention became the nominee. There's a natural order that Republicans follow. They're a very, almost, I don't want to say conventional, but predictable. It's like the Kiwanis Club or the Rotary Club. If you've been Sergeant at Arms, you're going to be the nominee. And this is a party that is ahistorical in 2016. It doesn't have a front runner. And I really think it's kind of fascinating to watch Republicans.
Unlike the Democrats.
The Democrats have this. They have never nominated the front runner. Never nominated the front runner. They always nominate somebody at the back of the room who excites people, whether it's George McGovern or Barack Obama.
So are you trying to tell me we're going to have an exciting race for president this time on the Republican side?
I think the Republican race is fascinating, and I do not write off Mitt Romney. Mitt Romney's speech tonight before the Republican National Committee may be the most important speech of his career. I mean, he's got to say something new and different, I think, and engaging tonight. If he just does the Barack Obama's bad, we're good, he's going to fall flat.
This is before the Republican meeting
That's
out
right.
in San Diego.
The USS Midway.
Yeah.
So one other thing I want to ask the two of you about. This week, the NewsHour announced and said on the air, we have made a decision not to air the pictures, the cover of Charlie Hebdo, the French newsweekly, of course, the genesis of the tragic attack in Paris last week. There's been a lot of viewer comment about it, the majority of it negative, some of it positive. But I'm just curious to know from the two of you, how do you think about this? I mean, our explanation is that we believe the offense that it could cause outweighs the news value. But there's a big debate about it. So I wanted to hear from the two of you.
I agree with the viewers, whatever they say. I've changed my mind about this. My newspaper, The New York Times, made the exact same decision. And I thought, no, the news value, you got to show what the subject of what all this fuss is all about. But as I thought about it more, when you actually look at the actual cartoons, some of them involve sodomy, some of them involve things that violate every standard of decency which we have. And so my view is that our standards of what represents decent behavior and civic conversation are more important in this case. And that if people want to see the cartoons, they go online, they go somewhere else. And my basic attitude is that when it comes to speech, is that we should almost never invite somebody off campus. We should almost never pass a law. But we should have certain social standards. What's polite? What's acceptable? What gets you respect? What doesn't? And maintaining standards of just decency, we don't curse on the air. And that just, it's a way of behaving respectfully, and that encourages conversation. So I think the call is ultimately the right one.
And we wouldn't permit a cartoon on our program that offended another group, a religious group, a minority group.
Yeah, I think that anything that's, I believe in the First Amendment and the stipulation, obviously, but it wasn't that these photos or these images weren't available. I mean, it wasn't, they were widely available, and anybody who wanted to see them. And I really think that when it comes to ridicule and satire, I'm a strong supporter. I'm a particularly strong supporter when you're doing it to the powerful, to the mighty rich, and those who have control over people's lives. You know, when it's deliberately and needlessly offensive, and especially in the case here, it struck me of those who are marginalized and in many cases powerless and poor. You and Gwen and the people at the NewsHour made the right decision.
Well, we wanted to hear what the two of you think, and I'm glad we were able to talk about it. Mark Shields.
We agreed with our bosses.
David Brooks. Thank you both. We'll see you next week. Again, the major developments of the day. The U.S. Supreme Court agreed to decide whether there is a constitutional right for gay and lesbian couples to marry. The issue will be argued in April. Law enforcement agencies across Europe rounded up more than two dozen terror suspects in a series of raids. The crackdown was spawned in part by last week's attacks in Paris. And President Obama warned Congress against imposing new economic sanctions on Iran. He said it would destroy any chance for a negotiated deal to curb Tehran's nuclear program. On the NewsHour online, good news for deadheads. To mark the 50th anniversary of the Grateful Dead, the four original members of the rock group announced that they will reunite for a final performance at Chicago's Soldier Field. You can find out how you can see that show, plus learn who's sitting in for legendary frontman Jerry Garcia, who died in 1995. That's on our homepage. All that and more is on our website, pbs.org/NewsHour. And a reminder about some upcoming programs from our PBS colleagues. Gwen Ifill is preparing for Washington Week, which airs later this evening. Here's a preview.
Tonight, we explore the world of terrorism post-Paris, the standoff between the White House and Congress over Iran, the jump-started presidential campaign, the Supreme Court on gay marriage, and we preview next week's State of the Union address. That's a lot to get to, but we will tonight on Washington Week. Judy?
And on PBS NewsHour weekend tomorrow, a very different story from Belgium, the nation with the least restrictive assisted suicide laws in the world. Last year alone, more than 1,800 people there chose to die by euthanasia, an average of about 5 per day. Megan Thompson reports.
So in Belgium, It's not just the terminally ill who can request euthanasia, psychiatric patients, now children. Is Belgium pushing the boundaries when it comes to euthanasia?
I don't think so.
Gilles Genicot is a lawyer and co-chairman of the Euthanasia Control and Evaluation Commission, which oversees the practice in Belgium.
The law humanizes the deaths of terminally ill patients on the one hand, and on the other hand, for patients who are not terminally ill but who are completely hopeless, there is a respect to the individual autonomy. I think it's a major advance in the way society, law, and philosophy see this very important issue.
That's tomorrow night on PBS NewsHour Weekend. And we'll be back right here on Monday when we travel to Nevada to see how the president's actions on immigration affect families. That's the NewsHour for tonight. I'm Judy Woodruff. Have a great weekend. Thank you and good night.
Major funding for the PBS NewsHour has been provided by IBEW, the power professionals in your neighborhood. And by BAE Systems, inspired work. Lincoln Financial, committed to helping you take charge of your life and become your own chief life officer. BNSF Railway. Carnegie Corporation of New York, supporting innovations in education, democratic engagement, and the advancement of international peace and security at carnegie.org. And with the ongoing support of these institutions. And Friends of the NewsHour.
This program was made possible by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by contributions to your PBS station from viewers like you. Thank you.
I'm Gwen Ifill.
And I'm Judy Woodruff.
Immigration, health care, conflicts overseas, the State of the Union.
President Obama is set to deliver the annual address Tuesday, January 20th.
Tune in for special programming from the PBS NewsHour team you trust, including analysis from Mark Shields and David Brooks.
When the direction of our country is at stake, there's only one place you should turn, the PBS NewsHour.
We'll be right back.